Good morning and welcome to Jew in the City Speaks with your host, Allison Josephs, also known as Jew in the City. We like to break down stereotypes about Orthodox Jews in this organization. Not everybody knows that Jew in the City is actually a nonprofit. And we like to do that in this podcast as well. I think a lot of times people associate sort of traditional Jewish music with klezmer only. There's just sort of like things that are more like tropey or stereotypical. And they don't recognize that Orthodox Jews are musicians and have a wide range of musical backgrounds, and some have become quite successful. Our guest today is a man named Peter Himmelman, who's had a long career and successful career as a musician, and we're going to talk to him today about his new book. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Allison. Thanks for the intro.
Yeah, sure, my pleasure. So, I guess give us your background first as a Jew. Where did you grow up? How did you grow up in Jewish?
Yeah, I grew up in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. If anyone of your fans has seen A Serious Man by the Coen brothers, they will know that that's my city. The Coen brothers were from there. And we grew up in a conservative Jewish milieu, which meant in some ways that were I ever to have discussed God in a serious way in my home, it's likely that one of my parents, maybe my mom mostly, would have sought psychological help for me. It just wasn't a thing. And that stands in, distinction to the fact that my grandma spoke Yiddish. She was always in the house. My mother lit Shabbos candles. We'd gone to Israel. I went to Israel when I was 8 years old, which was exactly a year after the Six-Day War. And we kept on going to Israel all the time. So we were very Jewish, although I used to help my mom stud hams with cloves and make her shrimp scampi for her dinner party. So there was that sort of tension. But for me, sort of finding my way to observant Judaism was a very natural process in a certain way, because I always had a belief. When somebody says they have a belief in God, it's hard to categorize, well, what does that actually mean? Because once you start having a definition for God, it's likely you're not really talking about God. You're talking about a anthropomorphic or close definition. But I always felt that it was self-evident that the world had been created, that the world is in a constant state of creation. And maybe that's because I'm a bit of a creator, lowercase c myself, for so many years, that and understanding the process of manifesting things from a mere idea, it seems implausible to me that everything that we see every day, every moment, every movement of one's hand has to be the manifestation of a creator with a large C.
I love it. By the way, we made a video about this, which I'm going to send to you, and our fans can look it up. Orthodox Jewish Artist Partners in Creation. I'd heard this beautiful idea from Rav Kook that God left the world unfinished so that we could partner with him in completing creation. And we strung together a bunch of moments of different artists sort of doing their art as sort of a form of service of God. So what you're saying very much speaks to what we tried to convey, and I think that's very true. So what stage of your life? I mean, you seem like a very philosophical person, which isn't surprising. I think a lot of artists are, thinkers and philosophers. What sort of point in your life did you realize that, creation needed a creator, and you're also a creator as an artist?
Well, I mean, it catalyzed in a moment, really. And I think a lot of things do, whether it's, the conception of a child or the meeting of of one's besher. These things, oftentimes the most important things in our lives, are very instantaneous. For me, there was a somewhat propitious setup to this, given the fact that I've just mentioned that I always had this sort of nascent understanding of a creator. My dad, who was a heroic figure to me, died when I was quite young. The day after I turned 24, he had been sick for about 4 years before. And after he died, that was time for me to sort of move with my band to New York City, which we'd planned to do, but I didn't want to, you know, bail on my dad in his last day. So through that journey, a music producer named Kenny Vance introduced me to Rabbi Simon Jacobson, who has written the book Toward a Meaningful Life and is now a very close friend of mine. This guy, Kenny Vance, he said to me, and I'll try to do his accent. He's from New York. I'm from Minnesota. So look, Peter, I know a lot of people in this town. He was, by the way, very old. He was sent to review our show, our band show at the Ritz in New York City. We're in our like early 20s, and he came back this old man, and he was reviewing our show. He goes, I don't really know what to tell you about what I saw. He was 40 at the time. You know, so Kenny said that as we began to be friends, he goes, look, I know a lot of people in this town. I used to date Diane Keaton. I know Woody Allen. I've been in his movies. I was a music director for Saturday Night Live. But tonight, I'm going to take you to my main connection, a religious Jew in Brooklyn. Thinking that I would be somehow averse to that, but I was not averse. And we went to see with Simon Jacobson, and Simon was, you know, this is now 36 years ago. Most of your listeners may not have even been zygotes at that time. And I just really liked Simon from the beginning. He was just, I could tell he had like a glint in his eye. He was very funny. My first thought was, how does this big hirsute guy land this beautiful wife? I didn't quite get that at the time. Little did I know it was scholarship that made the difference. So Simon started talking to us, Kenny and I, and about Jewish things, and the conversation ensued, got more complex. And I'm getting to the catalytic moment in a second. Kenny was old, so he got tired. He left around 11:30. Simon kept talking to me, and I grew to become very close with him during that one conversation. I felt at liberty to speak my mind. And I said, well, what's the deal with all these pictures of the Rebbe on the wall? And they seem a little culty to me. And Simon, you know, nonplussed, he says, look, this is like a inspiring grandfather. That's why I have the pictures on the wall. I'm like, makes sense. Then he started talking to me about a tzaddik. And I was smart enough to understand he wasn't talking about the colloquial use of the word tzaddik. Mel Blumenthal, what a tzaddik. He got me a deal on a car battery. He meant something grander. And I assumed that he might have been talking about the Rebbe as well. And he said, look, a tzaddik could do anything. This is one of those conversations at about 2 a.m, right? So I said to him, really? Anything, huh? Can he fly? And again, Simon just looked at me with no defensiveness whatsoever and said this one sentence. And this was the sentence that got me into a Talis cotton the next day. He goes, look, to a tzaddik, whether they're walking over the surface of the earth or flying 30, 40 feet above, what's the difference in terms of a miracle? For a tzaddik, it's not a difference. I said, wait a minute. Are you saying that every moment in life should be taken as a thing of wonder and a miracle? Look, this is precisely what I'm saying. And is this axiomatic to Jewish thought? Because basically, yes. And the point I'm making here in this languorous, long thread isn't that the thing was novel, the idea, more that it harkened back to something that I always knew, but I didn't have a community to reinforce it. I didn't have a language to express it. And it was at that moment, and given the fact that my father had died, which already set me in this very, as I mentioned, propitious place to hear such a message, I was probably the fastest guy ever into observant Judaism ever. You know, as I joke, I was the fastest guy they ever got into the cult.
Well, you know, what I love about this story is that it was a truth that you knew that you didn't know was part of your own truth. And there is that, you know, medrash that the fetus is being taught Torah while, you know, in the womb, and that right before the baby comes out, the angel touches the lip and the Torah is forgotten. But when we learn Torah in this world, parts of it will feel familiar. And so that's what I'm reminded here. I'll tell you a neat story of a reader that we came across years ago with a little bit something similar. She said to me, I'm technically Jewish through my grandmother, but she converted to Catholicism through the racial laws in Italy. And I don't really like her or mother very much. So kind of like, why is Jewishness through the mother? And I explained for genetic purposes, so we can prove that this is your lineage. And I told her the story about the angel. And she said, that's really fascinating that you shared this, because I went to Catholic school. And the first time that we learned an entire section of the Old Testament, my teacher said to me, you must have learned this somewhere before. I think there are these moments where Torah just feels familiar or sort of connected to what we know. So it sounds like it didn't take too much to sort of draw you in. It sounds like your soul was sort of already there, and then you understood that this is where it comes from. So that's really beautiful. So let's talk about your career now. You are an award-winning singer, songwriter, musician. You have composed, you know, music for television. You've been nominated for a Grammy. How has your Jewishness sort of impacted your career? Give us sort of like the career overview, some of the highlights, and then, you know, any moments where you were able to work around a thing, any moments where you couldn't do a thing because of Shabbos or Yom Tov?
Yeah. First of all, I'm going to go back for 1 second to what we were talking about before and then move into this idea of recalling something that moved you into a new direction. I just want to make the point that, at least for me and many people that I've, you know, observed or spoken to, the moment is never a one-time thing. It has to be recaptured every day, and it's very difficult to do. It's not like the moment of inspiration is going to change your life forever. It was just a beginning point. You have to find that beginning point over and over. So for me, I got signed to Island Records just before I had met Simon Jacobson, to give you a little chronology there. And it was a huge deal for me. It was a big record deal. It was the kind of goal that I'd always wanted to achieve. I mean, it was something phenomenal at the time. And I was on MTV. I was, you know, my videos were playing and we were touring. I was offered a tour with Sting. And around this time, I came up to was the president of the record company, this Italian guy named Lou Maglia, who was a fantastic person. He died, you know, several years ago. And he was such a champion of mine. And I told him one day in a meeting, I came, you know, to his office in the Village in New York. I said, Lou, I'm starting to keep this thing called Shabbos. And Lou had been around a lot of Jews, and he'd heard of Shabbos. He laughed, and I won't use the invective that he used at the time. He goes, Shabbos, Shabbos. He thought I was literally kidding. And I said, you know, I'm not really kidding. And then we got into a kind of a theological discussion. And when he realized that I was serious about it, he became a huge supporter of mine, which was almost impossible to do. So when I was turning down these tours, one, you know, was proposed with Sting. We did another with Joe Cocker and Greg Allman, the ones that were in the summer, so I could play on Saturday night. He, you know, he kept supporting me in this, and everybody along the way was supportive. I never found people looking askance at me because I was into it. It was real, and it has remained real. What it did for my career, it absolutely slowed it down. but not Judaism per se, like Judaism wrecked my career. When my first child, who's now 35, I think, Isaac is his name, was born, I was on the road for 230 days. And I just realized that as important as becoming a rock star was, it wasn't number one. It was number two. And I don't think being a rock star is number two anymore for me, but making music and creativity is number two. It's not number 1207, which is like where tennis is for me or swimming. You know, there's so many myriad things that we're involved in. But the first one, the first thing at the top of the, you know, tree here is God and family. It sounds like something from like some Old Testament person, God and family and country.
Can I tell you what I like about this is that women usually get the work-life balance question about managing it all, and it rarely goes to the men. And I would say that Orthodox men have been sort of framed in media as misogynist and, you know, not helpful, not good. And to see you prioritizing family like this, I mean, I think it's right and good. And I think for all the people that have success in their career and not much else to consider, they're lacking something. They're lacking something foundational. So yeah, maybe our society would sort of associate you with something old fashioned or sort of, you know, freaky deaky, but it, to me, it sounds good.
I hope they do. I mean, I'm definitely old fashioned. I mean, it's like, I mean, I play with all sorts of different musicians. My group of friends that I grew up with, I still play with, are amazing musicians. They're some of my best friends. I play with musicians from all over the country, all over the world, different creeds, different hues, different backgrounds. And we talk about this stuff all the time. Everyone understands it. Everyone gets it. Anyone that sits down like on a drum set, for example, it's almost like I studied karate for many years. I asked the sensei, so in the beginning, if you see somebody walk into the dojo and he says he's a fourth degree Dan, you know, he's like, how do you know he's real? And this guy said to me, well, I watch him walk. If I see a person sit on the drums, just sit down, I watch him hold his sticks. I watch something in him and I already can assess. And if somebody's a really brilliant drummer, they have this duality to them. One, this absolute like elitist, cocky, yo, I'm confident. But at the same time, the best are aware of whence their abilities come. Understand that this is a magical, mystical gift that they've developed, but it's not only about them. It's this kind of humility married to this, damn, I'm going to do it. I'm going to kill them, you know? And it's a beautiful thing to watch and understand. I talk about Hasidus with people and Shar Yichud V'Amuna, if you've ever studied the Tanya. This part that's, you know, how to know aspects of God, they get it like this. It's easy for a musician.
So a lot of Bali Chuva, a lot of people that become observant get pushed back from family. Now you have your family, your father passed away before you did this. You have your wife's family. She's, you know, her father is Bob Dylan. How did those dynamics work as you know, started this observant life together? Where did she come into the picture in terms of your journey? How did your families react?
Well, my mom, in terms of Judaism, is kind of a mixed bag with the whole thing. I mean, I think that she had, you know, she's the daughter of immigrants. She's the daughter of a woman from the shtetl in Romania. And I think a lot of her life was escaping from that stigma, trying to be a modern woman. I never had that challenge. I was, you know, born in America. So the idea of keeping Shabbos, for example, I don't know that it delighted her, nor do I think it delighted her now. The family that I've raised, my children and grandchildren, which I think are a manifestation of this lifestyle, certainly delight her. It's unclear whether if I hadn't taken this path, it's hard to, you know, go do a counterfactual on one's own life because it's, you know, it's already, it happened, but it's unlikely that I would have had the same family. So she had trouble with it and maybe still does. My dad would have been into it. He died early. Once he took me to a conservative shul in the morning, just randomly before school to put on tefillin. It was the only time we ever did it. And then we went to McDonald's for like a bacon McMuffin. And he said to me, we should do this tefillin more often. We never did, unfortunately. As far as tefillin goes, is to add to like reactions or what I assume the reaction would be. I started sort of surreptitiously putting on tefillin when I was 15. I got a pair from my older cousin, and I used to smoke pot, if that's allowable to say, in the bathroom in our basement when I was 15. I would blow out the pot through the window well in the backyard, and that's where I would put on the tefillin, because it was so weird. This is where I thought somebody's going to take me to like a psychologist. What's Peter doing? Tefillin. It was really my thought. It's just too weird. So there was a tension. My brother also was like, he used to say, my older brother, you know, religion is a haven for losers who couldn't make it in the real world. Without my saying anything, he became from years and years ago. So obviously it's a contradiction to what he'd said before. He doesn't consider himself or anybody that's from a loser anymore. So it wasn't a very difficult battle, but I don't think that people were, wow, this is amazing. You got to do this. I've always done unusual things and continue to do them. So maybe they became inured to that, to Judaism the same way.
And for your wife, did she become observant before she met you? What was her journey? I think
that, you know, everybody's on there. First of all, let me just say one thing about, somebody said to me, Huma carved you. I never liked that expression. I didn't know really what it was. I didn't like it. Somebody told me that the Lubavitcher Rebbe didn't like it either. In other words, who's to say you're far and I'm close? Who's to judge? And to say that I became observant, I don't believe you meant anything wrong about it at all. I aspire towards observance because I don't think it's a static thing. If you would have been in my mind while I was davening, you know, 20 minutes ago, you would have seen a guy who is just like racing through it and grasping for any kind of meaning at all. If there was 0.0001% of that davening that had anything to do with connecting to God, it was a miracle. It's more about not being frum per se, but aspiring towards seeing the miraculous at every moment, which is so difficult. Mm-hmm. This book took me about 5 years in two iterations of two separate books. And I kept thinking, none of it feels right to me. And I was working with an editor at the time to kind of help me think it through. And she's a brilliant person, happens to be a religious Catholic, which I found out later. And while that second iteration was coming to the end, I sent her a piece, and the piece, a little 1,200 word piece, it was called Suspended by No String, which became later the title of this current book. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, Barbara, maybe we can shoehorn this piece into the book that we've been working on, the sequel to Creativity. It took her 2 weeks to get back to me. She said, I hesitate to say this because you may interpret it as bad news, but if you have more like this, I suggest you shelf everything you're working on and write an entirely new book. And it was such a liberating thing for her to say that. Because in some ways, the book, which became Suspended by No String, was like writing songs for me. Mm-hmm. And the gist of the book is called, hopefully the subtitle will help listeners understand what the book is about. It's called Suspended by No String, which kind of denotes, without sharing too much, you know, the miracle of just the earth floating around in space. It's nothing we ever think about. Suspended by No String, a songwriter's reflections on faith, aliveness, and wonder. And it's a yeah. series of essays. Some are very short, some are a little bit longer. Some are extremely joyful, some are tragically sad. It's not trying to teach anyone anything. It's not a pedantic book. It's really my experience of striving to feel this, the original impetus that drove me to observant Judaism, trying every day and not succeeding many times. Mm-hmm. It's a lot about the struggle. Mm-hmm. It isn't a sort of like Shabbos, it's so beautiful all the time. It's like, it's real. And I've done so many things, I have so many records out there and done so many things. This, in some way, when I think about a legacy, which happens when you get to a certain age, it just probably happened recently. I'm 64. I sort of always feel like I'm 24. I look at my face, I'm like, dude, you ain't 24 anymore. But it's something that I really just feel is so much about what I want to say to the world. While my songs are sort of opaque expressions of this, this is a little more clarity around it. Mm-hmm. My hope is that people that read it, and there's many readers have, you know, written to me that are not religious in any way, have said, one guy, he's a musician, not Jewish. He wrote to me from Brooklyn. He said, look, he's like somewhat of a hipster. He said, look, I've wrestled with, quote, religion. And I always keep religion in quotes myself. And this is the first thing I ever read that felt like it wasn't trying to push something on me. And it's really made me think differently about my whole thought, my whole paradigm as to whether the world is just a result of random forces or whether it's being created and sort of conducted as a conductor would in music. He goes, I'm not saying I believe in God, but it's brought me to a different level.
You know, I would say in our world, as it is continuously tumultuous and, you know, on more fires every day, certainly for Jews in our post-October 7th reality, I think there is a spiritual yearning that is out there like never before. And so I think Suspended by No String could maybe be something to quench that, you know, yearning and thirsting that so many people are feeling, maybe not for the first time in their life. And people can pick it up on Amazon, Target, any place, and major book selling websites. Yes.
Yeah. It's coming out. It'll be released on, the day after Tisha B'Av.
August 14th.
Yeah. So you can pre-order it, whatever.
I'm
yearning and thirsting myself. That's why I wrote the book. It takes one to know a yearner and a thirster.
All right. Well, we wish you much hatzlacha on your journey and continuing to inspire and feel wonder and help others do that as well.
All right. Thank you, Allison. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. And you can catch us same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.